Good morning, everyone. This is Shannon Smith coming to you from the ELI Online Conference Command Center in the basement of the historic Washington Hilton. I'm here today with today's closing general session speaker, William F. Patry. Bill is Senior Copyright Counsel at Google and will be speaking at 10:45 this morning on how to fix copyright, a very simple topic that I'm sure he'll be able to cover for us in just a few minutes. Before joining Google, Mr. Patry served as Professor of Law at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University. He was also Copyright Counsel to the Committee on the Judiciary of the U.S. House of Representatives and was also Policy Planning Advisor to the Register of Copyrights and an attorney in private practice. Widely recognized as one of America's top copyright scholars, Mr. Patry is the author of several books, including 2009's Moral Panics and the Copyright Wars, and the forthcoming How to Fix Copyright, both from Oxford University Press. Welcome to ELI, Bill.
Thank you. I feel like I'm in the command center, actually.
I wanted to start out. You've spent, looks like up to two decades, researching with copyright issues. When did you realize that copyright needed fixing, or did you know immediately?
It's been almost three decades, actually, and I'm beginning to feel that it's been three decades, because you hear many things over and over again. And so I would say it took me an embarrassingly long time to realize that there were issues. The copyright bar was for a long time centered in New York, Los Angeles, Nashville. And it was a relatively small group of people. It was a group of people who mostly represented copyright owners, and there were a number of different interests to represent: motion pictures, records, authors, theater people. A lot of it centered in New York. There was the Copyright Society of the USA, which still exists and was a principal sort of organ for people who were interested in copyright to get together. They would have lunch events, dinner events at Sardi's, which was, you know, an event that you went to never for the food, but the ambience and the company. And it was a really very nice group of people. People would argue about things passionately, but they're all friends. And so it was a good discussion. I think copyright owners dominated the group, and that was fine. They had the most money to hire you, and they also had, they believed, the ideological high ground. They were the ones who created things, or at least bought them from people who created things. They were the ones who were responsible for culture, for learning, and for all of the things that make for the hallmark of a great civilization. So it was a very self-congratulatory crowd, but with good reason. It was people who were genuinely devoted to art, literature, music, and theater, and who lived that life genuinely. And it was really fun to be a part of that. I began actually here in Washington, D.C., as a full-time copyright lawyer, I believe in 1982. And I actually live right around the corner from where we are right now. When I came here, I was in private practice. I worked with a wonderful copyright lawyer named John Baumgarten, who had been the general counsel of the Copyright Office under Barbara Ringer, who was a legendary figure in copyright. We represented motion picture studios and sort of a Washington practice, which means legislative issues, perhaps test lawsuits. And it was really a wonderful time, and I learned an amazing amount. I then went to work for the Copyright Office as a policy planning advisor, as you mentioned, participated in a lot of legislative initiatives, including the adherence of the United States to the Berne Convention in 1988. I then went to work for Congress. I actually just walked right across the street because the Subcommittee on Intellectual Property's offices were in the Cannon House office building, which is right across the street from the Copyright Office. So it wasn't physically a large move.
Could you speak up just a little bit?
Sure. However, while it wasn't physically a large step, it was, I would say, mentally a large step. And for this reason, until that time, which was 1992, I had lived in a cocoon of other people like myself, specialists. And copyright owners like to say that copyright was the Cinderella of the law. That it was involved in, you know, very glamorous, exciting, interesting things. And there was a great deal of truth to that, I thought. The issues were interesting issues. They were issues involving works of great culture, which is a lot more fun than fighting over contracts or parking lots or real estate. And the issues were very abstract. They were fun issues to think about. So I had lived in that cocoon, and I liked it a lot. When I went to work for the House of Representatives, however, the boss of the subcommittee was Congressman William Hughes, who had spent the previous 12 years as the chair of the Crime Subcommittee. Mr. Hughes took over the Intellectual Property Subcommittee because he wanted to do something different, and he was interested in the field. But he was in no way a specialist in the field at all, which is why I was hired. What I learned, however, was a perspective of copyright from a genderless view. Right? So members of Congress, I think like federal judges, are probably among the last generalists in professional society. Right? They're not specialists in any particular field, although members of Congress who serve over long periods of time in positions of responsibility on committees come to be some sort of specialist in those committees. But generally, members of Congress aren't substantive experts in particular fields. And Mr. Hughes was no exception in that regard. For him, he wanted to enact what he thought was good policy, and he brought to that a pragmatist approach, which is he wanted to do things. He didn't want to introduce legislation to make political statements. Mm-hmm. He had no interest in that. So he wasn't going to introduce legislation or spend his time or anyone else's time on something that wasn't going to pass. I think that's become something of the exception now. On top of that, since he was a generalist, he didn't have any particular ideological viewpoint on things. He wanted to figure out what would actually work and what would work in terms of what the problems were. So he was a problem solver at a policy level, but he regarded himself as a problem solver. That turned out really to be the best thing that ever happened to me professionally because I had been in this cocoon and I had seen everything through the eyes of those who, like myself, professionally grew up in the cocoon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when that happens, you cut yourself off from other people. You cut yourself off from other viewpoints. And so I began to see things differently by virtue of having a different job and by virtue of my boss not coming from that background. And that was really quite wonderful and quite refreshing. And that was really the path that I still tried to stay on. And what I've come to realize is that when you're a specialist or when you care passionately about something, it's a great thing because it's what motivates you, it's what interests you, it's what keeps you going. At the same time, you become your own worst enemy for personal growth. Right? So I fully believe that I am my own worst enemy for my own development because of the assumptions I have, because of living an unexamined life, right? That's the old Socratic saying mm-hmm. that an unexamined life is not worth living. If you are living in that sort of cocoon of people like you, then you tend not to examine yourself. And I was very fortunate to be with somebody who didn't have that problem. So that's actually when I began to see things differently. And what I saw differently was that legislation was being passed in ways that wasn't effective. So you hear a lot these days about we need strong copyright laws,
mm-hmm.
or conversely, we need to abolish copyright laws, or we need weaker copyright laws. I've come to believe that those are not only meaningless sayings, but harmfully so. Right? To say that you need strong something or other is a meaningless term, because what you need is to solve whatever the problem is. You don't need a particular prescription that's strong as a general matter. Now, you may at some particular point. So if you look at medicine, you could say, well, most doctors will say that's a good idea to take one aspirin a day. And that would probably be true. It's not a good idea probably to take 5 or 10 a day, because other things happen. You can get bleeding ulcers. You can damage your kidney. You can damage your livers. So to say that you need strong medicine may be true in a particular case, but it's not true generally.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe it's true that we need strong copyright laws just to have strong copyright laws. Conversely, I don't believe that we need weak copyright laws either. Neither of those terms make any sense at all. They're ideological terms. They're rhetorical terms. What we need are effective laws always. And it'd be hard to argue that we need ineffective laws. Right? However, you have to judge what's effective in a few ways. You have to judge it by what the purpose of the law is, and then you have to judge it by the empirical data by which you determine whether that particular purpose has been effectively implemented. And to date, I would say the copyright has acted as a faith-based enterprise. It has not been based on much empirical evidence at all. Professor Jamie Boyle Doyle says that copyright exists in an evidence-free zone. I would actually say it's worse than that. There are, in many cases, evidence about the impact of particular legislation, but too often it's ignored. So I've come to believe that what we need to do is to figure out what the purpose is we want to accomplish, and then try to accomplish that based upon whatever evidence we can muster, and sometimes you can't get complete evidence. We don't live in a world of perfect information. But that's what we have to strive to do. So I would say, in terms of how to fix copyright, which may be your next question,
yep,
so if I'm
preempting
you, I'm sorry. That seemed to me a good segue. So how do you fix copyright? The first way to do it, I think, is you have to fix yourself. So my mother told me that I had a religious duty to learn every day. And I have another friend, Judge Pierre Laval, who's a judge, who said that the best way to know that you have a mind is to change it. So I've come to the conclusion that the first thing you have to do is unlearn as much as you can. And by that I mean divorce yourself from the things that you thought you knew and figure out whether they're actually true. This is, again, the Socratic thing about an unexamined or examined life. So there's a lot of things that we think we know that we don't. And there's a lot of things that we think we know that are true that actually aren't true. Or they can't be proved yet. So if you can't actually establish something, then you should go back and try to figure out what to do. Try to get more evidence. Try to make the best judgment you can based upon the evidence that you're able to gather. And that, unfortunately, really hasn't been the case. But I think we have to do that each as people. I have to do it, and I try to do it. Sometimes I'm successful, sometimes I'm not, but I certainly try every day. And I think legislators have to do that, too. So the first thing is to be honest with yourself and try and unlearn as much as you can, even if you come back to the same place. My friend Judge Laval, who said the best way to know you have a mind is to change it, really does that in how he judges. So he'll take a problem and he'll look at what other courts have done, including his own court. He sits on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan. And he tries to figure out, why did we get the way we are? You know, how did we get to where we are? Why did people say something? Does that actually make sense? That is also another very valuable thing I learned when I worked for the House of Representatives, which is we tend to look at laws as if they were written in stone, as if the people who wrote them knew what they were doing, came to the right conclusion, came to those conclusions based upon the evidence, which is how you would know whether they made the right conclusion or not, and that particular conclusion implemented in legislation is the best solution for right now. And what I learned was that, in fact, it's just people trying to do the best they can, hopefully, and trying to do the best that they can, and that you can change things. And it was really an exhilarating experience to take apart legislation. So when someone comes to you with a proposal or you have a proposal, you know, you draft what your changes are. Right? So you're making a change to an existing document. When you do that, you have to figure out where it's going to fit, how it's going to impact other things that are already there. You could do that in a superficial way. You could just sort of, you know, plop it in there and go on. Or you could do it in a more systematic way, which is to figure out why is the stuff that's already there, right? Is there a reason somebody did something that way, right? So young Jewish children, when they're learning, the first 5 books of the Bible, read commentary by a medieval commentator called Rashi. And Rashi has these little pithy statements on particular passages of the first 5 books of the Bible. Now, they're very short. He doesn't explain why he made a comment. He doesn't explain why he commented on this and not that. So there's a technique, and it's called What's Bothering Rashi? And the question that you have to ask yourself is, why did he bother to comment on this? What was it that was bugging him? What was it that he thought needed to be explained? And if you look at legislation that way, it's quite wonderful, because you look at legislation generally, I think, as the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably not the healthiest way to look at it. The best way to look at legislation is, what was the problem, right? What was the question, right? What was bothering Rashi? What was bothering
at
Congress?
At that time.
Right? At that time, right? And then you go back and you figure it out. A very humbling thing to figure out, to find out when you do this, is that the people who did it did a great job. They actually thought things through really well. And if you were doing it now with hindsight, which they didn't have, right, you would do the same thing. That's really fantastic, and it really connects you to things. So what we have to do, I think, is that same process with everything. Right? We have to figure out what's there, why is it there, can we do better? And that's what I try to do every day. And so in terms of fixing copyright, if you have, I think, that same humility, that same willingness to look at yourself and look at the things that are there, figure out what the problems were and how they have to be solved now, that's a great step forward.
Well, Bill, you went in a completely different direction than I was expecting, and I really liked it a lot, because you've actually given me hope about the political process in general and about where copyright might be able to be fixed down the road. And I understand that is going to be the topic that we cover this afternoon. And someone on our online, in our online audience asked, how is copyright broken? And I think you're going to give us a little background of that when you do your session, correct?
Sure, but I can say something
okay,
now.
Okay, and we just have a couple, we just have like 1 minute, so if you wanted to give us just a quick...
Right, so how is it broken? I think it's broken because it's not accomplishing what we wanted to accomplish. And I would say further that, in fact, it really can't in many ways. It can't because there's a view that law can do things it can't do, especially copyright law can do things I don't think that copyright can do. I don't think that copyright provides an incentive for people to be creative. I think people are creative because they want to be creative. I think what copyright can do is to protect people who have done things because they're creative, and it should do that. But I think we overpromise it. I think we expect to do things it can't do. And what we have is a free enterprise system. We have a marketplace that's a winner-takes-all marketplace, right? So I was thrilled that Esperanza Spalding won the Grammy over Justin Bieber. Not that I dislike Justin Bieber. I don't have any feelings for him one way or the other. But she was a fabulously talented person, and he is a product. He's a product of the industry. Now, you know, he will always sell millions more records than she ever will, even with her Grammy. And rightly so. That's people, in the sense that if that's what people want to buy, that's what they buy. I actually have listened to Esperanza Spalding's music, and while I think she's a fabulously talented people, it's not to my taste. So, you know, I'm not going to buy her album because, you know, it's not the sort of music that I like. But I recognize that she's amazingly talented and more talented than he is. But there's nothing that you can do in terms of copyright law to make people buy more of her albums. I'm not going to buy her album because it's under copyright. I'm not going to buy his album because it's under copyright. I don't buy anything because it is or is not under copyright. I buy it because it has value to me. Right? And so it's really value in the marketplace that establishes things. And the marketplace that we have is a winner-takes-all marketplace. It's a Justin Bieber market. It's not an Esperanza Spalding market. Now, if we want more Esperanza Spaldings, and I hope that we do, we have to do other things for them.
Okay.
Right? And so what I would like to see is to have an honest discussion about what it is we want copyright to do. If we want copyright to be there for Justin Bieber, it is, and that's fine. If we want to have Esperanza Spaldings or other people like that, we have to do something else. I hope we want it, but we need to figure out what those other things are.
Very good. Well, I'm looking very much forward to your session this later this morning. And for everyone in the online audience, I know we have some other questions that are bound to come out, and I will be doing your session moderating, so I'll watch for your questions. So when you get a chance, make sure and ping one for me, and I'll make sure that Bill gets it. And at this point, I know Victoria is getting ready to put up your links for your next streams, and I'd like to thank you so much, Bill, for coming and joining us.
Thank you so much.
We will see you all very soon in our next session. Thank you very much.